good definition of skill is the ability to transform paint into something else, into skin or a cloud or whatever. And I think then we're talking about what level is the transformation on. And that's why I wanted to ask you about this thing about egocentrism, geocentrism, and heliocentrism as the three different levels of how high a painter can reach. And what kind of examples can you give for that?
Well, first of all, I have to say that you gave me the first or the top name of this pyramid of system, and that was heliocentrism, because there was a pupil of mine that had made a landscape that you had defined as a heliocentric picture. So after one day, I found the conclusion that you have three levels. That's very often used in philosophy. And I have used it myself. I mean, Plato used it. I mean, there is a lot of philosophers. Kierkegaard used it. It's very, very common. So the first level is the egocentrism. The next level is the geocentrism. That means, I mean, egocentrism means that you shall be yourself and declare yourself. You shall be, you are the, in the center. And so you have the geocentric, which means that you can manage to look upon the landscape, just like Aristotle is talking that you live in a town and you can see the end of the town when you are staying on the other side of the town. That is geocentric. You have control. Very, very political in some ways. And then you have the very few on the top, and that we call heliocentrism. And that is, okay, Leonardo, Aristotle, Buddha, whatever. So that is the three levels, and if we compare these three levels in painting, you will find, for example, you take a typical Picasso, a typical Sargent, you know the painter, American painter,
absolutely,
Sargent,
yeah.
And then you can take Rembrandt. And then you see something strange. You see that Picasso looks like a children drawing, that is egocentrism. And then you have the next one, and that is Sargent, and he looks like he has control. Control over what he is doing. And the level with Rembrandt is that in some ways you don't have the same control. You're going to be more transparent. So you can say you go from a children drawing to an opaque painting, Sargent, and at last Rembrandt as a more transcendent atmosphere that you really can't understand it really. So therefore you are always going back to the late pictures of Rembrandt, because he was in many ways for many years what you can call opaque, typical Hollandish painter, and he changed more and more into a sort of a transcendent world where we love him most, I think, most of us do.
And I think you can, I guess you can see the difference between geocentric and heliocentric also in the Thorn Crowning by Titian, those two versions.
Oh yeah.
One, and they're like 30 years in between or so. And the one is, and that's interesting too, because you can talk about it in terms of specifically how it's painted. So it goes from clear lines, clear colors, describing a lot of what is going on, all the details of the whatever, the shoelace or so, etc., into something that is more dissolved and is not so strong in the color and is much more focused when it comes to where that the viewer shall have the attention.
Right? Yes, you can say that a clever boy, you can call the first. And the latest, or the last picture, is a mystery, right, in some ways,
yeah,
because you can't really get rid of it. And my examples very often goes from the late Rembrandts to the late Titians. And there is something strange there, because we can't leave the picture in some ways. We have to stay in front of the Falconer of Rembrandt, the picture of the tanks in Gothenburg. Mm. And at last I have to go, you see. But it's always hard to go, to leave it.
Yeah, and I think also Constable is an example of that. We've talked about that before, but these, the late so-called six-footers,
yes,
leaping horse,
yes,
for example, just take one example.
The where leaping horse is fantastic.
Yeah, and it's so clear that he had, how should I put it? It's like the geocentric level. One thing is that you describe everything and you're a good boy. Mm. But it's also how you relate to society. You respect the laws of society, like Sargent respects the law of society. He is in society. And with this leaping horse, the exhibition painting, Constable respects the laws of society so he can exhibit and get money.
The bad one.
Mm. Yeah, but then he makes the so-called sketch, the Rembrandt version, and that's where he starts getting into
Yes, I know where. I know. I had to. It hanged one time for some years ago, 10 years ago, in Copenhagen, and I had to go to Copenhagen 3 times, I think.
Mm.
So important it was, and I said to my wife that this is the same as Titian. You have the same feelings as, yeah, for Titian. I think there is a... My son, Ode, has said something very smart. He said that Titian make the sketch as the top of the picture.
Yeah, right.
You see, he goes the other way. He makes the sketch as last on the top of the picture.
Well, that's the thing about starting with a sketch, working with it, and adding the sketch,
yeah,
on top again.
Yes, in some ways. So you can say that his eyes has to renew every time when he meets the picture. He has to make a new picture on the same picture.
Mm.
And that we are talking about empiric understanding. When we talk about empiric work, it is just that you make something, and the next day you see that it has to be remade, and the next day it has to be remade, scraped out, and then you continue to paint, scrape out, continue to paint. A lot of layers and a lot of scraping.
Mm.
He called it, my son called it a sort of, what do you do? When you are having a spade in your hand, you know, you grow. You try to get deeper into it, you see.
Digging.
So you are digging and digging and digging, and people probably think you are totally crazy, but but you are after the absolute expression.
It's the
that thing is possible to get. You don't leave it like a sort of a presentation and something modern thing that you present something, but you represent again, again, and again.
Yeah, those concepts, or the idea of presentation and representation.
Yes.
Is that all about the same as geocentric and heliocentric?
Or? Yes, in some ways. You can say it's a little bit different. You meet a man, and or he comes to your door and knock at the door, and you open and you talk to him, and in that moment it is presentation. But then when you want to know more about him, you have him into your table, and then you continue to have a dialogue, and then it begins to be representation.
Getting to know the person,
yes,
quite simply.
Then you begin to get contact with him, and you begin to know who he is. And strangely enough, the modern art life don't like representation. because it's too private. And I'm wondering, why is that so bad? Is it because of the modern way of thinking psychologically? I don't know. Can you answer me?
Well, I've thought about at least three possibilities.
Advertising, here. Perhaps? That the advertising has
ruined the
originality of being a representational in some ways.
That's probably part of it. Yeah. I mean, there are different ways. You can talk. Of course, you can talk about the philosophical aspect here, the whole rules of modern art, which says that you shouldn't be sentimental or dramatic because that's barbaric, as Kant says. Mm. So stay out of it. Don't go into human content. Mm. But then there's also the political aspect that it doesn't serve politics if something is too private. I mean, it's that, for example, I read about the German sculptor Kolbe, who worked for the National Socialists. Mm-hmm. But then he started to make these embraces and these things, and then they stopped using him because they couldn't use him for propaganda, right? And then, of course, there's also this... That's something that Jung talks about, which is more the general attitude of the culture, where he talks about Protestantism as a basically iconoclast movement. Because one thing is that they destroy paintings, but you should also not think in terms of symbols or metaphors or myths, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these things, I think, go together with that sort of so-called rational approach where you don't get... I mean, this is Courbet, right? I don't paint angels because I've never seen one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the way to kill storytelling.
It's very strange, though, because... if I make representational, then public doesn't like it, actually.
Your images, your paintings.
Yes, yes. But if I do something presentational, mm. not representational, mm-hmm. then they like it very much. So my picture, Dawn, was very popular because they have no contact with each other.
Just open mouths and, yeah.
Yes. And the same with this singing women, five singing women, they have no contact with each other.
Mm.
But at once, when you get contact, when somebody gets contact in the pictures, as in movies, I mean, the movie is totally dependent on representation. Because people don't want to go to a movie if they don't get this kiss and this soft contact, you see.
Mm.
So, and that is very strange. It's just like in movies, you have the right to be representational, but not in paintings, because
well, that
I think it's very strange, actually.
That goes to show that perhaps... political and these other aspects, commercial, as you mentioned, is one thing, but I think the most fundamental thing is the art ideology.
So you think that...
because that doesn't apply to the movie industry. I've been reading books about screenwriting, and it's all about primal.
Yes.
This has to be in there. If that doesn't work, do exactly this, and then it will work, and then the audience will come out crying.
But you see...
There's no shame.
It, you know, I was thinking about the philosopher... Mr. Kant, yeah. Immanuel Kant, the hammer, Kant's hammer didn't reach movies because movies didn't exist in his time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But representational picture was, of course, attacked indirectly by Kant. And maybe it is simply a heritage from Mr. Kant. I don't know exactly, but perhaps it is something.
Well, it's definitely that, because that's what all the artists, art historians are saying. They are quoting him without knowing about it, of course, because they haven't read it. But it's just that those are the rules that are in the name of the game.
But you know, when you look at the Greeks, for example, Polygnot... or Polyclet, not Polyclet perhaps, but Praxiteles, Phidias, and so on. you had an extremely strong representational way of looking at people.
Hmm.
And they look at each other. and they have contact. Mostly of these things are destroyed by the Christianity, but I think in the Greece, representational was the highest level. So, and you know, the aggression against the Greeks are extremely strong among artists. If you are an artist, you will never accept the Greeks. It's a sort of a hate program against the Greeks.
Yeah.
And that's very strange, because I can't find another answer on that, that it's because it's so fantastic made. Because when you look at all the other cultures, like the African, the Indian, the Chinese also, you can, everybody in our world can feel a little bit that they have the upper hand. But when they look at the Greeks, the best of the Greeks, they understand something when they see a foot, for example, on the Greek statue, compared with a Roman foot, for example. I mean, Rome was in some ways America today.
That's a geocentric
part. Yes,
right.
It's opaque.
Yeah.
And you see the Roman foot and you see the Greek foot. It's, as you said, opaque. Mm. Opaque contra life. Life is the Greeks, and that's why the Greeks are so strange in the history. We can't find any culture. If you look at the cultures at all, who would you be close to, or
who would you be
a part of?
Yeah.
The Chinese, the African, no, not the Chinese.
Not on that level, no.
No, no, no. So there is only Greece again left.
And
the Greece is left.
And I think
the only people you could think you could live together with and have a conversation with and have a culture with, you see.
Yeah.
They had one wife, not 100 wives, you see. For example.
Hmm. And I think also it's important, maybe not a major point, but I hear sometimes people are talking about envy. But I don't think that's the problem here. For example, when you read about the early Christians and how they destroyed these sculptures, I don't think they were envious, but it was ideologically wrong.
Okay.
So I think that's what you come back to all the time. They see that it's better, exactly what you're saying. But I think the main thing is the ideology. The ideology is wrong, because this is a way of working that says that reality exists. And this is the true reality, not some abstract.
But there is also one thing we must not forget about the Greeks, that was the evil didn't exist. Evil mind, the devil, didn't exist. So if somebody did something wrong, they was astray.
Yeah.
They were astray. There wasn't evil. It was because they were astray. They didn't understand what they had done in some ways. So they have to understand what they had done, and then they will be good again in some ways. And that's very interesting, because I have heard that the evilness, the devil, was created in Israel in about 85 before Christ. And the evilness was coming into the world as a sort of...
This polarity, either good or evil.
Yes, good or evil. It was something like a psychological change, that evil suddenly existed.
Yeah.
And that is very strange, because I feel that perhaps to be evil is a little bit opaque, I think. And also the hate is opaque. And you have it in the German... music, as Kant loved, it was military music, and that's very opaque. So it is strange things following each other. There is a pattern here. For example, you make a very strong God, that is God, or the Christian God, and in the same way, you make a God that are tyrannizing all the time, because it's so good. compared with the Greeks. I mean, Zeus, the Greek god Zeus, wasn't better than Weinstein, that filmmaker Weinstein.
Yeah, yeah.
He was even worse than Weinstein. So there was also a lot of other gods. So you had a whole family of gods, and they had human instinct and humans behave. They behaved like human.
So,
and then you are not afraid, and then you, in some ways, lives a more harmonic life. We can't, in our culture, we can't really understand how harmonic it must have been, because we don't have to be so afraid.
Yeah.
Because that God, the gods doesn't really see you. They can meet you in the street, but they can't see you when you are on the toilet or you are in the bed or some private eras.
Yeah, there's not that shame. Yeah. So many gods perhaps can create a great respect for the different aspects of being human.
Yes.
Accepting that there are different aspects of being human. Because what Kant does when he talks about that sentimentality or these things are barbaric, is to say that it's evil.
Yes.
This is something you must never be in touch with.
Mm.
But with the Greek gods, there's all kinds of situations going on and being accepted, or at least not completely condemned, right? And if you didn't have that god, you could go to some river and there was a god there and who could be your friend, and then...
you can say it can be your friend, but it can also hit you. So you must be dangerous. I mean, thinking about Diana, she could kill people simply. And and for example, Apollon, and he took this guy on the picture of Titian, Marcius, was killed by Apollon. So you had to be careful, just like with Pallas Athena and Arachne. They were competing about the best weaver, and Athena was winning.
Well,
in the same time, Arachne was reduced to be a little elder, you see.
Mm.
So it's a warning program also. Be careful.
Yeah.
It can be a god that you have insulted, and then you are...
So on the one hand, you have Odysseus meeting this princess Nausicaa and asking, who are you? Are you a goddess or a human being? And then on the other hand, you have this thing that happens if you think you are superior to the gods.
Yeah.
And that's what I was thinking about. When we're talking about late Rembrandt or late Constable, then Titian, to stick to those, we're talking about this technica machia. And it was just an interesting example of that myth in practice, when there were some students of you who thought that they had 30-year advantage on you, starting with a late Titian much earlier than you did, and so they could become even better. And their whole technique and the whole work just fell apart because they thought they were the gods. They thought they were on a much higher level than they actually were. They didn't take the empirical study to get to the
level,
right?
Well, you can look at Picasso and Munch, for example. Munch, the man with the scream, that he in many ways had a very sad end of his life, because, and also Picasso. It's just like they had been burning out in some ways.
Yeah.
And if you look at Titian and Rembrandt, they were at the top until they died, and they made the masterpiece just before they died. The Pietà of Titian and the prodigal son of Rembrandt. So they were in the highest level just before they died.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't say that about Picasso, because that was really, he was burning out from 30 years old and so on, and he burned out. So, and that is because they didn't follow their personal instinct. They were probably follow the society's instinct, but not the personal instinct, because in the personal way, you have to be better every day.
Mm.
You have to improve Every day you have to improve.
Well, that's the way of the discipline, not the personal way, but the way of the discipline, the way of the craft. Or,
well, you can say that if you are longing for improvement, you will have no problems with that. It is hard, but you have to be better. You can't. It's something very problematic here, because to be better, what is that? Yes, you can follow Aristotle's ideas there, that you have the nature, and the nature is a sort of a measurement for you. Just like you have this 1 meter in Paris, because every carpenter has to agree about the meter.
Yeah, so there's a standard meter.
Yes, of course, because if there wasn't a standard, all the houses would fall apart, you see. You understand? It's So I think there is a sort of a human factor. This to improve is the most wonderful thing you can have in sight, you see. Mm. Because the other things doesn't work, really.
But then you need to know what the goal of that improvement is, because you need to study nature. But we've been talking about many times throughout the years about how if you are a naturalist and you think that describing everything is to be a good painter, then you're going the wrong way.
But so to be a naturalist, naturalists are very opaque.
Yeah.
That's the problem with the naturalists, because they just describe, you can call them very passive copyist.
They don't add storytelling or add pathos or dramaturgy.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the reason is that you have a melody and you can arrange a symphony orchestra, but you have to have a melody or something of a theme that grips even yourself in some ways.
Yeah, so an author who is only concerned with the correct grammar and has no story, that's a tragedy, right?
It was...
or not a tragedy.
I heard about Herman Melville.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And his manuscript looked like hell when the publisher got it.
Yeah.
So they had to restore the whole thing.
It was a technique of mocker.
Yeah, very. So it's a sort of a strange... But I'm coming back to this this linear world. We are living in a linear world, and you can say that that's okay, but it is actually not okay, because a linear world is a metaphysic world. It is not reality.
But with linear, you're talking about this belief in progress, things.
Yes, of course. Yes, of course. And if you see the circular world, that the Hellenistic world was a circular world. Hmm. So it goes with nature. You know, you had celebration for Venus in the springtime, you see. It was a feast in the springtime, because they should make children. And you make children with women, and you have seed corns and everything. It was about making corns.
Everything is planted.
Seed corn. And so the world for these people was totally circular. And when you have a linear world, you have... the Greeks could invent, like Archimedes, they could invent things sciently, but they didn't use it in that way that we think about science, that is a part of the linear world. It shall be better and better and better and better. The Greeks never used glass, because they felt that they had a clay, cups of clay to drink from. And that was good enough for them. Even they were on a much higher level than all the surrounding countries that used glass already. But they didn't want to use glass. They invented the damp machine. The machine, boom, boom, you know, like a locomotive.
Yeah.
And they was playing with it, but they didn't want to make a big concern.
Industry out of it.
Out of that.
Now we can go faster to Persia. Yeah.
So you had the whole Sparta full of locomotives, you know. So they didn't want it. So it's very strange, actually, because they had this sort of an ethical problem with new inventions in some ways. They were critical to that. Mm. And it's very strange, but these people that was so high up in the system, also, I mean, also in the way of solving problems in the society and so on, they were something they didn't like. So probably, I don't know, but perhaps these people or this society one time in what we don't know about has been in a sort of a tyrannic conflict. Mm-hmm. So I think for the Greeks to be a linear person, to think linear, would be a sort of a tyrannic way to think. And that's why it's so interesting, because they didn't live in any time. They lived in a circular time.
Yeah, and I think the metaphysics of linear development, it takes away your responsibility of improving. It makes people lazy. Because then you're just a part of something that moves in any case, no matter what you do.
So you get nervous.
What?
The linear time makes you nervous.
You have to follow. But it can also make you lazy.
You have to follow the group in some ways.
Yeah, so the virtue becomes to be a part of the group and not to actually create something of value.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm coming back to the Greeks a little bit, because in Metropolitan Museum, you see, there is several rooms for several countries and cultures. So you see the Indians from America, they have a lot of big, beautiful things, and it's in very good shape. And you go to the Japanese culture, that room, very good shape. You go to the African, with all the African sculptures, perfect shape, everything is fine. So you go into the Greek room, and it looks like they have gone through a big, big war, because you can see an arm here, a torso without a head, you see. Mm. Totally destroyed. Everything is under the way to be totally destroyed. It was attacked all the time, several times, actually. So you see, when you come into the Greek room, it's not like all the other rooms, because they are perfect, all of them. There is not a glass that is broken. Come into the Greeks, everything is broken. So it must be something strange with the human mind that doesn't accept such a perfect world in some ways. So they have to destroy it. And then I ask you, what do you think about that?
Why that situation is, I don't know, but it seems to be a problem for people that they seek the truth.
Something is very strange.
And that truth with this monotheism has become something abstract. So there's a threat from, that's why you have this idea of not worshipping images, because it's a competition with God. You have St. Augustine going to the see a Greek tragedy. Afterwards, yeah. He is shocked over himself because he forgot God. He was so gripped by it. I don't know why this situation is in a human being, but it apparently is.
I wonder something. Perhaps if you took away this one God that follows after you all the time with his sincerity, that looks really suspicious, not very, you drop it totally. And you goes back to the god of the thunder, the god of the sun, the god of the earth, blah, blah, blah. Mm. And then you will relax. And then you are going into the wheel. And perhaps that is the way to be a harmonic person again. Because in this world, with this extremely powerful idea about the linear world, which is not organic, you have always trouble with your mind, with your yourself, because you yourself is a part of something bigger than the linear time.
Yeah, and that's
in some ways.
I was thinking about that when you talk about ego geohelio, or when we talk about the ego geohelio.
Mm-hmm.
The egocentric painters, because Munch was even though he sort of painted like Titian in his early 20s, mm-hmm. it just fell apart. Mm-hmm. And he had that ego idea, I think, way too much. Mm-hmm. So being too concerned with yourself is a hindrance to your work. You become too self-aware. You're not concerned enough with what the craft is and what a good story is, because mm-hmm. that's not you in some way. And I was thinking that you've talked about how those who are on the highest level, yeah. Titian, Rembrandt, Constable now, they are somehow quite similar. I mean, of course, you wouldn't exactly
interchange them, but
it's very, very similar.
So that's very interesting, because yeah. they're probably similar in all times.
Yes. If you could see Apelles paintings, that would maybe, for the sake of argument, would be exactly the same.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you hear when Plinius is talking or writing about Apelles, Plino is this, you know, this, yeah. you know.
Roman.
The Roman man that was killed by Vesuvius. And he talks about Apelles as it is Rembrandt he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Or Titian or something. And Titian, on his side, he probably got a little bit from this Plinius, because Plinius was going to be more published, I think, also Poetica,
Aristotle had a yeah. huge impact,
yeah.
in the Renaissance.
Very, especially on this Doomsday of Michelangelo and Dante, you know.
Mm.
He talks about that the dead world, the world of the dead, is the highest level in some ways.
Mm.
It's most difficult.
But is that because there's no social...
You have no props from the world you live
right.
in.
Right.
You are totally alone with bodies and perhaps some rags or something. So it is the most difficult way to make a drama or a...
Yeah.
He talked about these three levels, Aristotle. You know, the first was the sarcastic, more funny theater with a lot of intrigues from the time they lived, and then you have the tragedies that was where everybody had to be beautiful and stay like this, you know, like that, very elegant. And then he comes to the most difficult, and that is the life of the death in the death world, you know.
Mm.
And I don't know, he never talks about 1, 2, 3 in that way, but you can't.
You can see that.
You can do that in the same way as we talk yeah. about egocentric, geocentric, heliocentric.
Mm.
That you are talking about something that is very difficult to talk about, and that is yeah. the death, the world of the death. Puccini was in that way very interested to make the last opera, but he died before he...
But that's... maybe we could talk a little bit about that, because I've been thinking about something. That's the thing about you, speaking of props. Using props.
Yeah.
I mean, so you have in your paintings, sometimes there's an airplane or there's a wheelchair, and yeah. then, of course, you can say, we could talk about Andrew Wyeth, or you can see, if you read The Great Gatsby, or you read Moby Dick, or even Dickens, they are fairly specific in the time, although they're not naturalistic about it. It is a specific time, it's not just, it's not some strange, weird landscape, right? So. Mm. Can you make something heliocentric from a specific time, or is that completely impossible?
I'm afraid it's impossible.
Yeah.
You have to get out of time.
Mm.
Because then you are in some ways in the prison. prison among a lot of props, you see. You have to get rid of it. You have to come to the core in some ways, because if you come to the core, then it's their body. And if it looks very cold, you can have some rags or something, skin or something. But it must not take too much attention. You can see in the last pictures of Titian, and also in Rodin's Bourgeois de Calais and Rembrandt, that the clothes, you know, the jackets or something, it's not so exactly painted as some of these Hollandaise people that could painters could make silk, you see.
Yeah, and the chessboard floors.
So
and,
it could make women crazy. It's so delicate and so wonderful. But Rembrandt doesn't do that, and Titian doesn't do that at last. In his last pictures, it's just hanging something here. But it doesn't really, are not really defined so exactly. It's a little bit clumsy in some ways. Because it shall not take attention from the face and from the drama, you see. So it's a sort of, something has to be superior. And what is superior? Yes, that the human expression, you see, that is the superior, Rembrandt. I have heard you said to one of your friends that Rembrandt, the little ice time was still in Holland, so therefore all the Rembrandt figures, they were freezing. So they had to have so much fur and everything. So
they're sitting in front of the fireplace all the time.
You could just see the hands here, you know. A little bit of the glimpse of the hair, of the hands, and then you see the face, and you don't see the body at all. It doesn't exist in some ways.
And maybe that, depending on the level you're at, it's easy to think that, you have to show that you know a lot of anatomy, and you can't hide it with a lot of clothes, and so on, and Rembrandt is cheating with all those clothes.
He's actually using the little ice time very well.
To his advantage.
So the result of what he is talking about is that a good picture is something that is eternal. That this a bit, it's a sort of a hierarchy. And you have to follow that hierarchy, because if you don't do that, if you are a typical geocentric person like the politicians, they are very much in the geocentric era. Then you have to strive to get a little touch of heliocentric, you know, a little touch of it. I don't think many people can reach it, really. It's so few. And therefore, they have no power, these heliocentric people. You have 70% of egocentrics. You have 30% of geocentric. The geocentric can never win if they can't get a little bit of the 70%, the masses, you see. So that is the problem. They must always talk nicely to the 70%. And on the top, you have the heliocentric, and that is so little that this isn't even one of 1,000. It's one of millions, perhaps. I don't know. And there is something strange here, because people don't like to hear these things, because we live in a very Marxistic time, where there are Marxistic rules. You hear it in the radio every time, that the Marxism are following after people. They have to be born very poorly, and they have a big career, and that's right. But you can't be born as a lord or something, because then you will be evil the rest of your life. All this Marxistic trouble.
Oppressor oppressed.
That the Frankfurter School has made a lot of talk about, all in America, in the South America, all over the world, they have made propaganda for this, that, as Jesus said, the little shall be the big one, and the big one shall be little. You know, that is in the Christian program in some ways. And Marx is just a follower of the Christianity. It had to come, the Marxism, because
of Christianity.
The Christianity was falling apart for a second time. First, it was when the Renaissance was coming, and then it was when Rousseau, Voltaire, David, all these people, in the, under the before the revolution in France, Christianity was totally destroyed in many ways among the people that had, you know. So therefore, you can say that we are living in a still in a Christianity tyranny in some ways through Marx, because the end of the history is more or less the same. Vote for Christianity and for Marx, that everybody shall be happy at last. So get rid of problems and all these things.
So what is the solution to that?
No, but you know, like this Smith and Locke and these people, they were talking about reality, about the working class.
Right, yeah.
And if they could have a chance, it would be solved in a very decent way. But Marx was a dreamer. I have read a lot of Marx. He talked about manufacture all the time. He had his groan in that, but his dreams was to make a superhuman, as you can see on the poster of the revolution in Russia. The big strong worker takes over, you know, takes over the power. The bourgeois time is over, and now it comes the working class people. And now we are in some ways in a part of a totally Marxistic way of thinking. Not you and me, in general. So the bad one shall be the best, and the good one shall be the bad one.
But it's a strange thing, because I've been thinking about that. We talk about the Frankfurter School, and this has developed or morphed into what now is called woke and these things. But when you see what happens then in general society now more and more, this is what we've been living with within the art world then for 150 years. The level that you the knowledge level that you have to enter has dropped dramatically, because skill is something old-fashioned and you don't need it anymore. So it has dropped dramatically. And that is just that same principles that is applied to the rest of society today. So that if someone really knows something and is skilled, he is, in the Marxist idea, put into the role as the oppressor.
Yeah.
Because there's a demand there for you also to become better, right?